From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Late last week, high on Mount Everest, Sherpas were doing what they always do in climbing season, making trip after trip over dangerous terrain, setting ropes, hauling gear, positioning food and tents for the well-heeled foreign climbers who will come behind. Then, disaster. A huge ice fall, 16 Sherpas dead, dozens injured, and instant big questions about the mix of wealth, poverty, glory, and risk that plays out every year on Everest. This hour on Point, tragedy and morality at the top of the world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the Sherpa disaster in the climbing season on Everest? Do you dream of going up there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's a relative of one of those who died in the avalanche, the ice fall on Everest. Unhappy about the compensation from the government, and lots of thinking and talk about this ratio of risk and reward on Mount Everest after last week's terrible tragedy with 16 dead. Joining us right now from Mount Everest Base Camp is David Brashears, celebrated filmmaker, explorer, mountaineer. He has a long history on Everest and has been watching firsthand as a drama over death, risk, and reward has unfolded in the last week. David Brashears, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What's this?
Sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask you about the state of climbing or not climbing right now at base camp. What's the atmosphere there, and what's going on? Is climbing season over, David?
Well, based on the meeting that was conducted just 30 or 40 feet away from the tent I'm sitting in now at base camp at 17,600 feet, the dining tent of the Himalayan Rescue Association, the climbing season is over. There's one remaining expedition that is thinking about giving it one last try, but most of the teams have agreed to pack up and go home.
David, I want to talk to you about how you see the bottom line of this whole tragedy, but give us a further sense of what's going on there. Are there still Sherpas on the scene? Have they all gone home to mourn and bury the dead? Who's there? Who's not?
Well, at the moment, the base camp is still quite full of expeditions, Sherpas, clients, and guides. The several days ago, the beginning of the exodus began immediately after this terrible, almost unbearable tragedy happened on April 16th. Many teams just immediately said, out of respect for the dead, out of respect for the living who know or are very close to the dead, we're leaving this mountain. There's a very profound and strong and pervasive feeling that the mountain is not a safe place this year, that it's not a very good year on the mountain. This tragedy has been compounded by poor weather, exceptionally cold and windy and cloudy weather, and yet there still are many, many teams here who had hoped that somehow there would be a way that they could turn the tide and head back up the mountain. But from the very beginning, there were many, many Sherpas who knew that that would not ever be the outcome of this awful incident.
David, can you describe for us what happened when so many Sherpas were up on the Khumbu Ice Falls? What were they doing there, and what happened that led to so many deaths?
Well, it would be very useful for me, Tom, if I could just set the stage. A few hours ago, I was out on the glacier. The over 40 expeditions, international expeditions from many different countries, are arrayed along a narrow strip of debris-covered glacier. It's covered in it's ice-covered in with rock and big boulders. and looking to the south, I would have seen to my left the looming massif of the west, the shoulder of Everest, over 24,000 feet high. You cannot see the summit of Everest from base camp. Just to my right, as I look south, I would have seen the northeast shoulder of Nuptse, another part of the Mount Everest massif, again, over 24,000 feet. And those two massifs descend in a narrow defile, a steep valley or almost a gorge. And beneath that narrow entrance into the upper reaches of the mountain is the icefall. And the icefall is a 2,000-foot cascade of ice, a river of ice, exiting the western combe, which leads to the upper slopes of Everest. And it falls over 2,000 feet to base camp. And it's quite a chaotic jumble, a mess of ice towers and crevasses. And the place is alive. It moves. It has an accumulation zone. The snow accumulates, and the pressure from that accumulation causes this snow and ice to be forced through this gap that we all have to pass through to reach the upper slopes of Mount Everest. So teams who were following the fixed ropes that had been fixed all, to Camp 1 had headed out carrying the loads. Most of them were Sherpas. There were also Tamangs and a Gurung and other ethnic groups in the mix, as well as some Westerners. And you come to a point where the vast, broad, lower reaches of the icefall compress into an exit into the upper the upper reaches of the mountain. And at this point, the route is forced to the left. There's no way to exit the icefall. The lateral crevasses are too deep. They're impassable. And you're squeezed underneath these massive seracs. Now, a serac is a hanging glacier. This serac is 300 or 400 feet thick. It's been hanging there for many hundreds or thousands of years. And occasionally these seracs release tons, hundreds of tons of ice in massive ice blocks. And unfortunately, a large group of Sherpas was in this area at the time, not far from exiting the icefall and reaching the safety of Camp 1 at about 19,500 feet. And it's just almost unthinkable to try and imagine that hundreds of tons of ice fell 300 or 400 feet onto this line of Sherpas and others carrying loads to Camp 1. And it caught these climbers, of course, completely by surprise. A few minutes earlier or later, I've been told the fatalities would have been much more. Climbers had stopped repair at a ladder along the route. And I think one thing to really remember that's made this catastrophe cause such a deep impact, besides the loss of life, is the tremendous violence of this event. Of the 16 people who died, all of them died of massive unsustainable blunt force trauma.
David Bershears, they're at the base camp. Forgive me, you're beginning to break up a little bit, and I know I only have you for another minute and a half. What do you see here, bottom line? Is there an injustice? Is there a moral quandary in these Sherpas carrying food and tents up for the mountain climbers from abroad? What should happen in the aftermath of this tragedy?
Well, everyone here, and Tom, you have me for as long as you like, but it's, you know, besides the nature of this of this tragedy, which has caused the Sherpas not to return to this mountain, there's a tremendous amount of confusion here. There's heartbreak, there's sorrow, there's despair, and And nothing like this has ever happened here. And things have unfolded so quickly, and there's not a lot of clarity in communications between the Sherpas and the Ministry of Tourism and the Western climbers or the Chinese climbers or Japanese climbers on the mountain. And the outcome right now is, although there's a lot of opinions and a lot of commentary from the West, as we sat down here tonight and we said, I sat with the Sherpas and many others, and people still don't know the ramifications of what happened, what the outcome will be. It's going to take a long time to sort through this. But I would like to point out there is no finger pointing. The community, the Sherpa community, is not angry at the guided expeditions.
David Brashears, celebrated climber, with us there from Mount Everest Base Camp, filmmaker, explorer, extraordinary mountaineer. We're very grateful to you for joining us. I know I have to let you go. Be safe. Thank you very much, David Brashears, for joining us. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Mount Everest and the Sherpas. 16 dead last week, high on the mountain, and now anguish over wealth, poverty, and vulnerability in the climbing world. David Brashears was just there with us from Mount Everest Base Camp, and we thank him for taking time high on the mountain to do that. There has been grief in Nepal in this last week. So many dead. Here's Fauzi Sherpa, father of Angkazi Sherpa, who was killed in that ice fall, that avalanche last week, saying here he's unsure how his family is going to cope. This from Reuters.
Now what are we going to do, this man says. He's dead. He used to take care of all of us with what he earned. There are many grandsons and granddaughters. It has been and will be very difficult for us. He used to take care of us all.
We're going to go to Kathmandu in just a moment, and we will hear from more top flight climbers. I want to go to Kathmandu, capital of Nepal right now, and Donatella Lorch, who joins us there. She's a reporter, interviewed many of the surviving Sherpa guides from last week's disaster for National Geographic. She's been keeping a close eye on the aftermath. Donatella Lorch in Kathmandu, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. A pleasure.
What can you tell us about the state of Sherpa demands at this point? I mean, we're seeing a list of a dozen things they'd like to see happen, changes in the sort of the fundamental deal for the risks that they take. What are they asking for, and what's the reception been, Donatella?
Well, they're asking for things that they've asked for before, some of them. It's all been triggered. The problems really started in last year when, I don't know if you remember, a year ago during the climbing season in Everest, there was a fight between Sherpas and several Western climbers. And that has festered and has the depth. The 16 deaths re-triggered this feeling of need to do something for their own groups and for the government to pay attention to them. Now, what they've asked the Ministry of Culture and Tourism is the obvious. They want better insurance. They want higher payment for injuries and for death. They want management of education of their dead and missing members. They want a rehabilitation assistance. They want, the government it hardly pays them. I mean, the government pays a very, very low fee. And the government has met with them. They're going up tomorrow again to base camp, high-level government representatives. And, you know, they do have a porters union. They don't have a Sherpa union. Unions in Nepal, some of them are extraordinarily strong and violent. I mean, this is the country of union strikes, not Sherpa strikes, but union strikes, student unions, Maoist strikes that can close down the entire country. The entire country can be closed down for and has been closed down for 5 to 10 days by Maoist strikes here. Are they going to get what they want, Tom? I think they're going to get a lot of what they want. Now, the question is, there's a very narrow window right now for them to resume. Now, from what David said, it doesn't look like they're going to resume because so many of the guiding companies are leaving. So is the government going to promise and then not deliver, or will the government promise and deliver? And the government doesn't have a fabulous reputation for delivering on time.
Here's a little bit of an interview. This was on Saturday, just a couple of days after all the deaths. And Sherpa, Jagpa Sherpa, who works on the mountain, saying here he wanted to see the season end. This is, again, from Reuters.
With yesterday's huge avalanche, in my opinion, I would feel better if all the expeditions for this year are canceled because 15 to 20 people have been killed. It would be in respect for them. If all the climbing Sherpas were to do this, it would solve the problem. Plus, the Nepal government should try to convince the expedition team and trekking teams as well.
It looks like 16 is the death toll as far as we know. And Donatella, we are reading that, in fact, a number of these expedition companies have indeed pulled back and announced that they're not going to take their clients on up to the peak.
Yeah, it's the big expedition companies, the ones that are the core to the climb of Everest that are really needed, the ones that set the ropes because they have the greatest number of Sherpas, and the ones who've been there the longest. We're talking about IMG, we're talking about a whole bunch of others. And interestingly, it's like the government in Nepal wants them to go up there because at this point, the whole trekking community and the whole mountain climbing community of Mount Everest is going to be transformed if there is no climb this year. If there is no climb this year, that means that a lot of people have lost money. The Sherpas have lost, I mean, they will be paid basic pays probably from their companies. It's individual company to individual company. But are they going to have jobs next year? Because next year, a lot of tourists won't want to come here. It's easier to go to climb in China. Not as beautiful necessarily, but it's easier and less bureaucratic to climb on the China side of Mount Everest. And people are going to summit this year in Mount Everest, but from the China side, and they've already started up.
Sherpas take a lot of risk. They make a good income, 10 times or more the average income in Nepal. Of course, a very, very poor country. But here we see the risks very concentrated and falling massively last week. When you spoke with injured Sherpas who had made it back, I guess, to hospital in Kathmandu, what did they say about the work they do and the compensation for it?
They said they were terrified, and they've always been terrified. One of them had been a climber since 2008, and he said he'd always been terrified of doing the Khumbu Icefall. And many climbers I've spoken to said they hated that, the most hated part of the climb of Everest. You know, Sherpas that have gone up and down Everest, they have a great saying, which is, we service the needs of many who come to claim Everest as their own. And The Sherpas themselves, the ones that I spoke to, were the hardcore carriers, the ones who travel the most, back and forth, back and forth. And they were very set. They didn't want to go climbing anymore. They were people who came from very poor backgrounds. They didn't have any education. There's whole levels of Sherpas. There's Sherpas with a small S, which basically identifies anyone who carries a load up Everest or acts as a local guide.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Sherpa with a capital S, which is the ethnic group. And the vast majority of Sherpas with a small S are Sherpas with a capital S. And they feel they come from, you know, you have incredibly wealthy Sherpas in Nepal. They're a small minority. But let's look at Nepal. It's the second poorest nation in Asia.
Mm.
Okay, it's competing with Afghanistan in terms of poverty.
Yeah.
And the poverty is widespread. You have to realize that one quarter to one third of Nepal's GDP every year comes from the millions of young men that go overseas to work in the Middle East, in Malaysia and India. And this is a country that there is massive underemployment. So one of the big dangers the Sherpas face is they cut their, it's been a traumatic experience. But if you're looking at it as an economist, what is their future for next year? And what is their future for the year after that if there is a move towards trekking elsewhere, if it becomes so expensive? I mean, they deserve to have an increase in pay. And I think everyone and the trekking companies agree. But that transforms the whole trekking economy. And how is that going to affect the Sherpas in terms of numbers of jobs.
Sherpas and the whole climbing kind of world here up against it after the catastrophe last week. Donatella Lorch, please stand by. It's so great to have you with us from Kathmandu. This whole romance of the Sherpa, but also the seeds, I suppose, of the tragedy we saw last week go way back. Here's a little tape. This is a post-climb interview in 1953. Sir Edmund Hillary and his famed Sherpa guide and climbing companion, Tenzing Norgay, recalled a near disaster during their historic first ever summit.
Tenzing and I had been climbing together a good deal, and I think we've become a fairly happy pair. And this was just one example of how a pair rope together are a unit, and how one is always protecting the other. I was leading down the ice fall, and when I was crossing a crevasse, a large lump of ice gave way on which I was standing, and I set off down the down a crevasse. Well, Tenzing, who was following, had the rope tight in a very short time and pulled me up, so I didn't go very far.
And how did Tenzing feel up there on top of the world?
He's very happy.
Tenzing Norgay there in that historic tape saying he was very happy at the top of the world. First to be there was Sir Edmund Hillary on top of Everest. And that ice fall that so tragically led to 16 deaths last week, they were very aware of it. Also here from a 1953 newsreel interview with his brother Rex, Sir Edmund Hillary, first man to reach the summit, remembering that dangerous climb and the ice fall overhangs that unnerved his team.
Well, I suppose the main highlights were the actual bits on the mountain itself. The ice fall, perhaps, was the most interesting thing. We were nervous a good deal of the time, and some of the bits of ice hanging overhead, so it made rather a keen impression on us. And with me especially, I think, the last summit.
Donatella Lorch is with us from Kathmandu. I want to bring in two climbers very familiar with Everest, very experienced there, prominent climbers both. Conrad Anker joins us from Los Angeles, professional climber, director of the Khumbu Climbing Center. It's a Nepal-based climbing school for guides and Sherpas. He knew some of the Sherpas, one of the Sherpas at least, who died in the avalanche last week, co-author of The Lost Explorer. Conrad Anker, thank you very much for being with us today.
Greetings, Tom.
And from Seattle, Peter Athens joins us, professional climber as well, renowned expert in high-altitude mountaineering, one of only four non-Sherpas to climb Everest seven times. People call him Mr. Everest. He's been involved in Sherpa labor rights and education. Peter Athens in Seattle, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, the Sherpas would greet you with Tongbu.
We welcome the greeting. Conrad Anker, who did you know who died in that avalanche, that ice fall last week? And what are you thinking here, a week on, from all that death and suffering?
The fellow that died that I knew, there was three that I knew, but the one I knew closest was Ankaji Sherpa, and he was with us on our 2012 expedition. He was one of the lead climbers. He set the ropes to the summit that year, and hearing his father's voice brings back his voice. He's survived by his wife, three sons, and three daughters.
Peter Athens, should climbers who tend to be well-heeled, it's expensive to climb Everest, should they be feeling some kind of, I don't know, moral shame or guilt or quandary this week after so many Sherpas died who were up there putting up rope and tents and food for them?
Tom, I think that probably they should be feeling grief. I think that they should be feeling that now is the time to find the silver lining to the situation, if there actually is one to be found. Is this a transformative moment where we can actually make some gains respective to the overall working conditions of the Sherpas, respective to their undercompensation, their underinsuring, and obviously just trying to overall improve the quality and the safety of the conditions that they have to meet day in, day out on Everest?
We talked with David Bershears, who's up at Everest Base Camp. You two know that terrain well. He was saying many Sherpas are saying this is just not a good year on the mountain. Conrad Anker, is it just random that we've seen such a big ice fall here? Does it have to do with weather, with seismic movement? Does it just happen? Is it just very, very bad luck that there were so many under that ice?
We don't know what triggered the Serac fall. And from my point of view, it's that it hadn't happened earlier is amazing. It is such a gauntlet of risk that you go through in the ice fall. It is so dangerous. And if you come at it with an experienced view, you realize the weight and the movement of the ice and how silly it is to be climbing in there and how crazy it is. But then it happened. It could have been worse, as David mentioned. I'd been in there in a traffic jam. It could have been 100 people if these fangs that hang over the ice fall had cut loose at that time.
I want to bring our listeners in. It's so good to have all of you with us. Jeff in Cambridge, Massachusetts is calling. Jeff, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks for your show. Just want to say that I have a very good friend who's a physician on her first ascent climb of Everest right now. She was in the base camp during the avalanche.
Wow.
She did part of the medical rescue.
Yeah.
And she represents, I think, what old school climbers would say, someone who earned their stripes. Over the course of 15 years, she increased her fitness. She climbed and climbed and climbed, went ice climbing, did all the things that she had to do. She quit her job a year ago, sold her house, and, you know, banked it on the climb. And certainly she's devastated by the loss of the Sherpas and the loss of her chance to climb. I don't think she's going to climb again. I think it highlights the point that, as you say, well-heeled Westerners can basically take a helicopter up to the base camp and then think that they're just going to walk up Everest, you know, with some oxygen support. And it's really not like that. And the Sherpas have been the ones who have borne the brunt of that arrogance.
You know, Jeff, I appreciate your call. You've got a friend up there who's in the thick of it. Conrad, we've got people, and Peter, we've got a listener asking us online here. Laura asks, Peter, I'll put this to you. She says, why can't they climb without Sherpas, or at the very least, have more climbers who carry their own supplies, Peter?
Well, the truth of the matter is that the climbers can actually take it upon themselves, and no one is stopping them from doing this, carrying their own materials through the icefall, managing the logistics on their own, managing the guiding on the upper part of the mountain on their own in doing so. I think when they're talking about closing the mountain per se, I'm not sure that that includes Westerners who choose to go above without the use and without, obviously, the support of additional Sherpa carries.
But have we, Conrad, gotten used to a kind of a cushy ascent of Everest where you're not carrying your own stuff that has the effect of putting more Sherpas at more risk?
Yes, that's the case. It's an easier mountain to climb than it was in 1953, but even in 1953, their expedition relied heavily upon Sherpa support. And yes, there would be fewer climbers up there if we all went self-supported, but it would take away a huge part of the Nepali economy, which is Mount Everest and the money that it brings to the nation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A Sherpa funeral there in Nepal this week after last week's tragic death of 16 Sherpas carrying supplies up Everest for the many climbers gathered there for the season. That season, climbing season, may now be over. Many Sherpas pulling out, many climbing companies pulling out. We have two big climbers with us right now who know Everest and the Sherpa role there very well. Conrad Anker joins us from Los Angeles. Peter Athens joins us from Seattle. And Donatella Lortz, wonderful reporter, is with us from Kathmandu in Nepal. She's been talking with survivors of last week's tragedy. Helen is calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Helen, thanks. You're on the air.
Thank you. I started climbing my first view of the Bernese Oberland. I'm now 78, so that goes way back.
Yes.
I had friends in Switzerland. Then I ended up in the Schwangunks, which people may know, not far from Poughkeepsie, New York. Met Hans Krauss, the great doctor, Connie Pruden, and had the sense of the health of the of climbing. Went out to the Tetons, climbed with Willy Unselt, who sadly died not terribly long ago of heart trouble, but he was a great pioneer in the Himalayas. Now I was a client. I paid. I wasn't any great climber, but I kept it up and went back to Vengen and then in Zermatt at last. And I know how the guides trained, how the guides cared, how the Explorers Club backed them up. And I did a lot of reading about it as well. My family took me to the Explorers Club in New York to hear Gaston Rebuffat speak.
So what do you think of this whole situation, Helen? What should we take from the tragedy last week?
Take what we Westerners have done to a beautiful civilization. I could see how the Swiss, the professional guides I knew in Zermatt, one of them had, they climbed in the Himalayas before oxygen. And I could see the whole thing developing.
Helen, cut to the chase for it. What should we take from the tragedy last week, please?
Where people here in Rhode Island pay millions, I don't know what the figures are, but they're thousands and thousands of dollars. It's no longer a sport. It's a trophy hunt. And it's the risk of these wonderful men, Tenzing Norgay, the men that Hillary made so much of and did so much for. We've lost all of the honor. And you and the New York Times ran something just 2 weeks ago, Nepal. Why pick up Everest trash? Because it's there.
Helen, I appreciate your call. We've lost the honor. Peter Athens, Conrad Anker, that must be painful to hear. It's not a sport anymore. It's a trophy hunt. How do you respond to that, Conrad?
People are still going to want to climb Everest. And we have this view that recreation doesn't justify risk. And yeah, if you're a coal miner or you're a salvage welder on a ship or something like that, or you're a policeman or a fireman and you're caught in the line of duty, then there's some honor to it. But with recreation, because we do it by our own volition, we do it for as an avocation, that it doesn't justify it. And if we look at what tourism is to the Nepal economy, it is the main driver there.
But what about when your recreation raises someone else's risk?
I'm aware of that. I am complicit with what I do. I promote Mount Everest. I'm a professional climber. I see the benefits of getting outside and climbing. So yes, I'm aware of it. And there's the inequality between the guest climbers and the people that work on the mountain is very noticeable. And it's something that it haunts us as we go to sleep at night.
Peter Athens, Sherpas are paid well in Nepali terms for what they do, but maybe not well enough. We have some pretty tough commentary online about this. Here's one of our listeners. I want to get your response, Peter, saying, the listener writes, I hope all the bucket list Westerners determined to live out their vain aspirations to conquer nature and have tons of photos to document their Everest descent are ashamed of themselves. These Sherpas are the true heroes, but those they escort up Everest are pathetic and have blood on their hands. Peter, that's a very, very tough, maybe too tough, but what do you say to that perspective?
I think that's a very strong comment, and I know that a lot of people are feeling such grief at this time that it definitely underscores it time and time again. That we hear these types of comments. However, I think that the narrative has changed. This is a transformative moment. I think we're not asking people why they climb Everest anymore. We're asking, how do the Sherpas climb Everest? What are the changes that we need to incite in this day and age that's going to diminish the disproportionate amount of risk that they assume and is going to provide for their families if they are disabled, if they're injured, or if luck is not with them and unfortunately they suffer the tragedy as what happened last week that they're killed.
Let's go to State College, Pennsylvania. Pasong is calling. Pasong, thank you very much for calling. What's your story?
Hi, I'm actually from the Everest region, and I'm currently an anthropologist at Penn State University. I study the Sherpa people, and I just wanted to say something based on what I've been hearing from within the Sherpa community.
Yes, please.
And I want to point out, first of all, that this is a very, very sad time, and my friends and I, we have been very hesitant to talk about this issue. But I think this is an important time that we need to come together and have our voices heard. And what I wanted to highlight, first of all, is that for the Sherpas, the expedition workers on the mountains, this is not an easy option. And this is the job that they choose because it's one of the best option that is out there in order to make sure that their children will not have to return to the mountains. And I also want to point out that Sherpa is the name of our ethnic group, but because Sherpas have done most of the jobs in the past with portering, taking people up the mountains or
yes,
guiding, so it has, the term has been used synonymously with these occupations. But these occupations today is not just occupied by Sherpas. that have also been occupied by other people. With that being said, I think throughout this program we have heard about the problem, which is the exploitation of the people on of the expedition workers on the mountains. So I think the question now is, what do we do from here, and why do we do? Why do we need to speak?
What do you think, Pasong? Do you think Sherpa should be back on the mountain in a couple of weeks? Should they be back on the mountain next year? What?
I think it does not matter what I personally think. I think what matters is that the Sherpas on the mountains who are grieving and grieving over the loss of their friends who were with them just a week ago. So we should let them go and process this disaster, and then have them decide what they want to do. But what I've been hearing from our friends back in Kumbu is that they do not want to go on the mountain. And how can anyone judge their position, right?
Yes.
If they still have few of their friends buried under the snow, how can they even go back on the mountains and continue climbing? So that is the real problem.
Pasong, I really appreciate your very informed perspective there, kind of Sherpa perspective right out of Nepal. I appreciate your call. Donatella, I mean, making this decision, right now people are in grief, but when the grief has passed, they'll still have poverty at their back, pushing them up that mountain.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's also, you have to look a little bit of perspective of the past few years of climbing. The number of climbers, of Western climbers, has increased dramatically in the last few years, which means at the same time, the number of Sherpas accompanying the Western climbers has increased. It's become more and more crowded. I don't know if you remember last year the pictures that came out of Everest of the traffic jams getting to the summit. And as a result, more numbers, more danger, more demands. There's also been a new level, a new type of Sherpa that has developed in the past few years, more educated than their fathers that carry the loads, more trained in terms of being guides and being high up there, and they have different desires from their own parents. Most of the survivors that I interviewed here, the injured survivors that I interviewed here in Kathmandu, they were terrified of climbing, but the reason they were climbing was because they weren't going to stay in their village and grow potatoes. What do you do in small Solukhumbu villages if you don't have a job either overseas or a job on Everest? You grow potatoes, you grow barley, you're a carpenter, and you cannot pay for the education of your children. The Sherpa guides that I met wanted more than anything else to pay for the education of their children so their children would not be guides on Everest. And so this is, the whole climbing world is coming to a really crucial turning point in Nepal, because what is going to happen? If the Sherpas leave their job, there's going to be plenty of other people. You know, you were noticed early on when David told you they're Tamangs, they're Gurungs. There was a Karki who died also. He's a Chetri. There are people from other ethnicities, from other parts of Nepal that are coming and moving in and will be there to take their jobs. Again, you are in massive underemployment in Nepal. Everyone is looking for a job and a way of being able to, you know, support your family. So right now they may be grieving, and I totally understand what Pasong is saying, and all the Sherpa families that I know speak the same way. When they lose, you mentioned if they want to go climb in several weeks. The climbing season's very short, and they should already be, and Mount Everest, they should already be, the Western climbers should already be at Camp 2 acclimatizing. And they're not there yet. One of the deals they want to cut with the government is that the government will ferry the goods and the tents and the cylinders of propane and everything else by helicopter up to Camp 2. So there's a small little window of opportunity. And after that, next year is a huge question mark for the Sherpas, for the Western climbers, and for the reputation of Nepal as the land of the highest mountain and the birthplace of Buddha.
Let me go to Sierra Vista, Arizona, if I may. And Daniel, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom, and On Point.
Hello.
I've been following this from the very beginning, from when it broke last week.
Yes.
And I can't help but think that given how terrible this whole thing is, I can't help but think that this is an opportunity now. And, you know, it's unfortunate it had to come to this, but I'm pretty sure your panel has brought up the reform of how Nepal needs to treat their sherpas and how they're paid. But I can't help but think that there needs to be fundamental reform to the whole expedition system to Mount Everest. I think you're familiar with the whole National Geographic story from last year about the world's worst traffic jam at the at top of the world. And I read that article, and I was profoundly disturbed when I read that article that the whole expedition system to Mount Everest has pretty much come to this, that the world's worst traffic jam at the top of the world, the people on the experienced people unnecessarily dying, and the pollution left on Mount Everest.
And of course, Sherpas put at risk. Let me put that to my guest, Peter Athens. Should we be pulling back? Is there just too much of the trafficking in Everest ascent? Should there just be less of it? Less garbage, less traffic, fewer people, and with all that, fewer Sherpas at risk, Peter?
Tom, I believe that people have been encouraging the Ministry of Tourism, obviously the Sherpa communities themselves, to be thinking about what they see in the future respective to limiting the numbers of expeditions there. Do we move forward with a situation as we have in our Grand Canyon for rafting? Do we move into a lottery-based type of system? Do we limit it to a dozen expeditions or 15 expeditions per year spread out a little more spaciously over the mountain? Are these some ways that we can help to mitigate these unconscionable risks that are taking place there? And obviously trying to do anything that we can to diminish these traffic jams at places as high as 28,600 feet near the south summit of the mountain. Having climbed the mountain seven times, I just find that almost like being in a situation where you're playing Russian roulette with no empty chambers. You know, there's going to be something that happens here. There's going to be someone who gets killed here at some point or another. This happened in the icefall this year, the second most dangerous place, certainly by the view of most high-altitude mountaineers. Most people look at the summit being higher, but the icefall being, obviously right there, right alongside it. And this is what took place. This was a random event. But this can happen anytime.
Donatello, we've got callers calling in and saying, it's not just Everest. Callers saying we climbed Kilimanjaro and, had porters climbing in flip-flops. They felt guilty about that contrast. I mean, people know the disparity, the economic disparity. Here's a listener online, Donatello. You've reported from all over the world. This is another tough way of putting it. But here Bob says, sure, this is tragic. But how different is it than getting crushed in a building collapse while stitching shirts? I guess he's talking Bangladesh, or getting poisoned to death. Yes, or getting poisoned to death, ripping apart e-waste, trashed electronics that we send abroad. I mean, this is a very dramatic and almost glamorous until the tragedy comes environment. But this is not an unknown dynamic, Donatella.
No, and you can find it in every country. You can just come to Kathmandu. You're looking. People sort of view the Sherpas as the only poor community in Nepal. I mean, there are poorer communities in Nepal. Everyone seems to want to come to Kathmandu. We're in a land of 12 hours no electricity a day, no water waste treatment plants, open sewage, go straight into the rivers, and in large parts of the valley, there is just no drinking water. And this is the capital of the country. And you can push this to Bangladesh. And I think that what we're viewing this, part of it is the incredibly positive stereotype around the world that for the past six decades has identified and personified the Sherpas. They are brave. They don't complain.
Yep.
They are strong. And I think that's just a creation of what we are, is you're climbing this iconic mountain. And I'm not saying there aren't problems elsewhere in the world. We have these arguments all the time at my house. My husband works in Bangladesh. Mm. There are, you can pick and choose the event, and when the next factory crumbles in Bangladesh, we will focus on that. But right now, what we're looking at is a very interesting phenomenon, because the wealthy Westerners are going to a country to take advantage, not really, yes, take advantage of climbing this iconic mountain in a place where poverty is so dire that they need to take that job. And it's, everyone is involved in trying to be at, everyone's at fault. Everyone should try to fix it. The government of Nepal is also at fault. By the way, they've lowered their fees to climb Everest as of next year. So that means more people are coming to Everest.
Conrad, do you see a fundamental turning point in climbing here, in Everest climbing here, Conrad Anker?
We'll either have to, we need to limit the amount of people on the mountain. We either do it by lottery, by experience, or by cost. There's just too many people up there.
Conrad Anker, great climber, great experienced Everest climber. Conrad, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
Peter Athens, great climber, 7-time Everest climber. Peter, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Donatella Lorch in Kathmandu, you give us a lot to think about. The whole sad story last week has given us that. Donatella, thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.